Hi, this is Greg Young.
And this is Tom Myers. Surprise, we're in your feed again. What are we doing here, Greg?
Well, we're in a little bit of a Hollywood mood. My favorite movie from last year was a movie called First Reformed, which was written and directed by Paul Schrader, who was just this week nominated for the first time ever for an Academy Award for First Reformed. Paul Schrader also wrote the movie Taxi Driver.
This is the first time he was nominated. He wasn't actually nominated for Taxi Driver.
No, nor for Raging Bull, which is insane. So because of this, and being in a Hollywood frame of mind right now, I thought that we would squeeze in a little extra surprise for you in between our regular Bowery Boys podcast episodes.
Because as you may or may not know, we've actually started a new series, a new podcast series exclusively for our followers on Patreon. We call this the Bowery Boys Movie Club. And in this, we discuss a particular New York City-based film.
We do a recap, but also kind of infuse the story with very New York City-centric trivia.
Right. We've done this on Taxi Driver. We did it on Ghostbusters. And we're about to release our third installment in the movie club, celebrating the classic comedy, Anti-Mame.
So we wanted to present to you the very first episode of the Bowery Boys Movie Club, which patrons received just a few months ago. If you would like to get more episodes of Bowery Boys Movie Club, you can support us on Patreon.
But for right now, we hope that you'll sit back and you'll enjoy listening to our take on the 1976 classic Taxi Driver in celebration of its screenwriter, Paul Schrader.
And to find out how to listen to more, check us out on patreon.com/Bowery Boys.
And now, it's showtime.
You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me? Well, then who the hell else are you talking to? Talking to me?
The Bowery Boys Movie Club presents Robert De Niro, Sybil Shepherd, Jodie Foster, and Taxi Driver.
Hello, everyone. This is Greg Young of the Bowery Boys podcast here with my Bowery Boys podcast host, Tom Myers.
Co-host, even. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our first ever Bowery Boys Movie Club episode.
Yeah, this is an inaugural show, a new thing that we're trying out that is exclusive for everyone supporting us on Patreon. Tom, why did we actually decide to do this?
Well, we wanted to do something. You know, we have struggled with trying to figure out what the right thing to give our patrons was in terms of an extra audio download. And so, as you know, if you've been supporting us on Patreon for a couple years, we've been putting together outtakes or longer versions of the shows or extended walking tours, you know, when we do a walking tour. And that's been kind of fun, and we've had positive feedback on that. But
sure,
it just doesn't seem like quite the right fit.
Well, it wasn't regular, and because the show wasn't regular. Sometimes we just didn't have extra material for something. Other times we'd have loads of it. So we wanted to do something.
So we want to become regular.
We want to eat our bran.
My grandmother always recommended Metamucil.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I think my dad had like a tub of Metamucil in the counter. But going to the movies became a very appealing idea because a lot of people, we actually got a lot of emails and requests from people saying, why don't you do, you know, such and such movie, like a whole podcast on it. And additionally, on the blog, there's a lot of stuff that I've written about movies. I have to say that I have a pretty deep history with film, like study and film, like interest in film. I mean, we're both interested in film.
Yes,
obviously.
But Greg, this is really your baby. I mean, come on. I think that my deep interest skews a little bit more toward musicals and the Broadway stage, and yours is really like on, you know, projected onto screen.
The concept of the show here is that we're going to talk about a great iconic New York movie. But we're not like film critics, although we're going to be very critical sometimes and we're going to be like opinionated. But what we're going to try to do as much as possible is put that film into New York City history context. Talk about like what is happening in the world, like in the setting of that movie or when it was filmed or whatever, and you know how history relates to the things that you're seeing in the movie, because I think it adds some richness.
So it goes without saying then that all of the movies that we're choosing for the Bowery Boys Film Club are movies that in which New York plays a very central role. So we thought that we would start the series with Robert De Niro, Sybil Shepherd, and Jodie Foster in Taxi Driver.
So let me give a situate.
Did I mention Martin Scorsese directed?
Oh,
sorry.
In fact, we're going to like, actually, let's get this out of the way first because we're going to say his name a lot. Scorsese. So I think
what say he?
Well, we are going to go probably back and forth and just say it and however we feel comfortable.
I hear you say Scorsese a lot.
Well, because he says it as Scorsese. So you would imagine, well, we should just say it the way he actually says his own name.
Right. If it's how Scorsese says it, that's how we should say it.
But most people actually say Scorsese.
Right.
And I think that there are other people with that name who pronounce it Scorsese.
I'm going to call him Marty.
So, Taxi Driver, just to give a situate.
All right, on the show, we situate the listener on the Bowery Boys podcast, but here you're going to situate the audience, situate the viewer?
Yes, just give some bullet point recaps of like placing this movie in a place and time.
Okay.
Right? So, Taxi Driver, directed by Martin Scorsese, written by Paul Schrader, was released on February 8th, 1976. So it was like a winter release. Produced, this is fascinating to me because as a film junkie, especially from the 90s, it was produced by Michael and Julia Phillips. Taxi Driver got rave reviews when it came out in 1976. But here's the thing that I didn't remember. I was a cognizant human being in 1976, but I didn't realize that it was actually a huge box office hit.
Now, like looking back, you're saying that right now you would not have expected the Taxi Driver would have been such a hit?
Yeah, well, think of...
It's dark.
Yeah, think of this like as a film and think of it when it came out.
There are scenes in this film that today, you know, 42 years later, are still shocking.
Oh, sure,
so
right.
Even watching it right now, I a few times thought, oh my God, like how did audiences react to this? So apparently they reacted by buying tickets.
Yeah, so I want to put it in context. So it was like the 12th largest film or the 11th largest film of 1976. But here are the films that made more money, just to kind of put it in a cultural place, depending on what list you looked at. I'll just list the movies that were like the biggest ones. Silent Movie, which was a Mel Brooks movie. The Bad News Bears. Midway. The Enforcer, which was a Dirty Harry film. And, you know, this Taxi Driver certainly borrows from some of the same Dirty Harry traditions. The Omen. And then, get this, Tom. Like the top five box office hits were All the President's Men.
Whoa.
Silver Streak. King Kong, the 1970,
the remake, yeah.
The remake. A Star is Born.
Oh.
Right?
What a year.
And then the biggest film of the year was Rocky. The film Taxi Driver was made by Martin Scorsese, Marty. Martin Scorsese, who was born in Queens, he was a NYU film student who made a big splash on October 2nd, 1973, with the movie Mean Streets. Now, did you ever see
that? Another great one,
yeah.
In which New York features prominently.
And then, I forget
and
this.
That might be on our list.
That will probably definitely be on our list. What won't be, but a film that I love and I forgot that he made, in 1974, he followed that up with Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Oh.
And that movie also features Jodie Foster. We're going to talk more about her later. Now, Taxi Driver went on to win the Palme d'Or in the Cannes Film Festival, although, you know, it was actually booed by some people. Did you know this?
Because it was too shocking?
It was very violent at the time. And there had been, I think the previous year, been some sort of an altercation, an attack in Cannes. And so, like, this idea of such brutal violence elicits some boos. But, of course, like, the best movies at Cannes get boos. Anyway, it got 4 Oscar nominations. It didn't win any of them. One was for Best Picture. One was for Best Score, and one was for Best Actor, and Robert De Niro, and Best Supporting Actress for Jodie Foster.
So regardless of whether or not it actually won the Oscars, it was a critical hit, and mm-hmm. it was a box office hit.
Yeah. Now, I know that's something that you were really into. I mentioned the Best Score.
Yes.
So it's Bernard Herrmann.
Right.
Let's just spend a second on Bernard Herrmann here, because this, believe it or not, so was his final movie.
Now, Bernard Herrmann is very well known, for many, many films, but for composing many of the scores to Alfred Hitchcock films.
Uh-huh.
And there is a Hitchcockian feel throughout
Absolutely.
Taxi Driver. You know, and the sort of wailing of the saxophone, but also like the deep timpani beats, you know. You're feeling, I mean, nobody knows how to build drama and suspense like Herrmann.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, he is, like, he was one of the few people that created the sound of Hollywood, pretty much, right? So what? Here he is, like, literally the last movie. It's almost like a weird passing of the baton to a new generation of filmmakers.
Right. And in that way, actually, this film is a kind of crossroads,
mm-hmm.
right?
Oh, yeah.
Of mm-hmm. old-time movie making and storytelling with a new way, avant-garde way of shooting and directing.
And
I'm sorry, I don't think that the old-timers would have actually shot the whole thing on location
Mm-mm.
the way that Scorsese shot on location all over. Can you imagine this film? And I know we're going to dive into here, finally. But I'm like, can you imagine if this thing had been shot all in studio or on like back lots in LA?
It would have been corny, or just like projections in the background
right.
or everything. But I'm glad you mentioned locations. Before we go in, we're going to go through the plot sort of like by major bullet points and talk about specific location and historical things. But there's one thing I wanted to preface with location and that we can keep in the back of our minds, which is so interesting because, of course, this film has been picked to death mm-hmm. by film analysts, critics, what have you.
We will be recommending some really wonderful blog posts that you can look at that even break down, including most notably Scouting NY,
mm-hmm.
where the author breaks down scene by scene where these things were shot and what's there today.
My little pretentious point that I want to make is that in terms of New York City, most of the film, and it's actually in several places, and we'll talk about the other places, most of the film takes place in 3 locations, and each of the locations represent a character. So when you think Travis Bickle, as we go through the story, you're going to think the seediest area of Manhattan in the 70s. And that is, of course, Times Square, 8th Avenue, 42nd Street. Then you're going to think of the character of Betsy, played by Cybill Shepherd.
That would take us farther uptown around Columbus Circle and the Upper West Side.
Right. And finally...
That's where she works, and that's where we see... I mean, we're led to think she lives at the end.
There's a sort of a cleaner like space around her versus the other characters, especially Jodie Foster's character, who is represented in the movie. You may be surprised that these scenes are in East Village.
Yes.
Didn't we talk about that? There's a bunch of things when you remember this movie. Like, I don't know the last time you watched it, but like, I misremembered where things were because I thought they were like, I thought, for instance, all the Jodie Foster scenes were in Hell's Kitchen.
Right. Yeah. I did not place them in East Village, which is funny because the last time, I mean, most recently I watched it, well, yesterday, but before that, it was about 20 years ago when I was living on the Lower East Side at Essex and Canal.
Mm-hmm.
And so to think that actually I was quite close to where those scenes were actually shot, but it does make a certain amount of sense because probably when I watched it in my apartment, having rented it from Two Boots, up on Avenue A, the streets would have been kind of dirty and gritty, and there were cars honking and garbage trucks doing their thing, and you know, graffiti still around. So,
mm-hmm.
I will note though that the last time I watched it, or the most recent time I watched it, yesterday, I watched it at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, which is funny and ironic because I was much, much closer to Sybil Shepherd. I literally I walked out of the library and it was a super rainy day. And I walked out and I was on the streets of Broadway at like 64th Street. And it was about a block away from the Palatine office where where Sybil Shepherd worked at 63rd and Broadway.
Did you tussle your hair? Did it blow back in the wind?
I did look around for handsome cabbies. Just hanging out.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, we're about to jump into the story, but there's one thing that I want us to keep in mind as we're going through the film here. It's filmed in 1975. And it was released in 1976. So the New York that it reflects is contemporary for the time. It's also, so 1975, that was the year.
The city's broke.
Yeah, I mean, that was this year the year that it almost went bankrupt, okay? Right. This is the Ford drop dead years here. So it although it would, in many kind of infrastructural ways would be bad for many, many, many more years, this is really in many ways the nadir. That's something to keep in mind because it's that will come into the story indirectly. They don't talk about city finances in the movie, but they certainly do talk about the condition of the New Yorkers.
And Travis does address it once to Palatine when he has him in his cab.
Yeah. Oh, right. Exactly. So we're going to talk about that opening, Tom. That horror, it's almost like a horror show opening with the taxi driving through the steam and we get the credits rolling. It's essentially we're seeing New York City through the eyes of Travis Bickle, who will be introduced here in a second. But it is the most hypnotic, abstract version of New York, a New York of your dreams or nightmares.
A New York of flickering neon signs and puddles of rain and wailing saxophones. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, you get the two main Herman themes at this time, including that saxophone, which is so over the top. This opening scene also introduces another kind of thematic aspect, which is reflected color. So through this scene, all these reds and blues, you're getting all these reds and blues very vividly kind of reflected in windows and everything. Scorsese plays with light to reflect the main character's psyche in this. And there's a couple scenes which I'll note that do, like the red and blue are gone and it's another color. So that's kind of happening in the background. So finally, the movie starts and we meet Travis Bickle, who is played by Robert De Niro. And he is going in for a job interview to be a hack driver, a taxi driver. Do you know why we know his name? This is kind of a curious detail. It's written on his jacket.
He has a patch.
Yeah, well, he has a King Kong patch, right? So it's a patch with King Kong, and then his name is written on it. And what we find out is that he was in the Marines. So I suspect this is a Marine jacket.
I would also point out that in the scene where he's applying for the job, we're inside a taxi company, and we're watching a man. There's a man in the background who's, like, barking out orders, to drivers. Get to 66, get to 66 and park, get to... And you realize, oh my gosh, right, like all the life that existed in this other world of like taxi ordering in a world that was very much pre-Uber and pre-Lyft. This movie would have been so much more boring if he had been an Uber driver.
If he was just driving around going like, they need to clean the scum. Bing, your next client. Please go to this corner.
I mean, he's complaining about like wiping blood off the backseat. Today he'd be complaining about like getting a 3-star rating on Uber.
He would go ballistic if they didn't tip him. Oh my gosh, that is a really good point. In fact, that whole space is so grimy and gritty, and it's like those like authentic voices. By the way, he is clearly already kind of a smartass and unstable, right? I mean, you can already you don't even know him that well at this point.
Just his job interview. Like, who would hire him in that situation?
Well, and the only reason he did get hired is because of the Marine connection.
Right, that's
because
true.
That's why I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, so, and I would also point out, you know, because this is a companion to our normal job and normal show,
yeah, uh-huh.
the Bowery Boys NYC History Podcast. We have a number of shows that kind of parallel some of the things that we're talking about here. Obviously, we have a show on Times Square in the 70s that we recently did. We have a show mm-hmm. on Columbus Circle that we somewhat recently did. Lots of different shows. We also have a show on taxis and the history of the mm-hmm. taxi business. I feel like that is the least relevant to this entire movie.
Weirdly enough, it's not about the daily workings of it. Like, I feel like the comedy... The TV NBC comedy Taxi was right. a more realistic depiction of taxi driving than this. Although I do think the conditions of the cabs were probably the same. But anyway, so we have to talk about when this amazing shot when he leaves and he's walking down 57th Street, Tom. And did you notice what was in the background of as he's walking east on 57th Street? Did you notice what was in
boy.
The back?
This is not him driving off in the taxi for the first time, talking about cleaning up the scum.
We're going to get to that. There's a structure that no longer exists.
Do you see the Coliseum?
No, it's the Miller Highway or the West Side Elevated Highway.
Right, which was actually defunct when they shot the film.
Oh, yeah, that was the crazy part.
It just hadn't been demolished.
And then additionally, there's like a pier structure that is also gone. In fact, if you were to walk down that street today, it is virtually completely like wiped clean. They've taken Travis Bickle's words to heart and wiped it all away. In fact, that via, that bizarre pyramid... skyscraper is there today. So let's get him into his apartment where he's writing in his journal, and he's like, that's where he says one of the famous lines, thank God for the rain, for it washes the trash off the sidewalks. And then he's eating terrible junk food. I'm on like a Mediterranean diet right now, so watching this whole movie I'm like, a quarter pounder with cheese, a Coca-Cola.
There's a lot of bad eating. You know, sometimes it's like dumping brandy on bread and adding sugar. Jodie Foster has a terrible looking breakfast at a certain point. It's just, you know, bad eating. But sure. So he gets his car, mm-hmm. right? And he does. He drives around. You see 42nd Street. And you see marquees and you see dirty theaters.
You see, for instance, Texas Chainsaw Massacre in one of the marquees. You see a Fascination arcade. So Times Square used to have these. And the Playland is also shown later. These are just like arcade skee ball type places that, you know, used to be all over the place in Times Square.
And then we see him go into one of the dirty films two side by side, the Show and Tell he goes into because he's an insomniac. So he goes to a porn theater because he can't sleep and he doesn't want to be by himself.
Now, the most incredible thing about that particular scene, by the way, is the fact that, you know, it's... Now, there are tons of movie theaters in Times Square at this time that are showing these, like, adult films, these French films, if mm-hmm. you will. What's funny to me is that I never really thought that people went into those things and bought, like, concessions. So when you walk in and he stops there and he kind of flirts with the woman and gets an RC Cola and some popcorn, Jujubes,
she calls it Royal Crown.
Royal Crown, right. Now, I have a very, very amazing piece of trivia for you about that scene. The woman who plays the concession lady there, her name is Diane Abbott, and she would become Robert De Niro's first wife. So he has insomnia. He's driving around. There's this whole scene. He picks up a man and a prostitute up at 48th and 6th. You know, he's cleaning off the it's like just nasty. He's like hosing down the cab.
And then getting it cleaned by driving through an open fire hydrant.
Oh, right. So he has all this insomnia, and we've been so far in this movie living in this sort of like filth, right? Well, then the next day, as he's driving, you know, and he's driving around during the day, he's up around 63rd and Broadway, so in between the Columbus Circle, Lincoln Square area, and that's when he first sees Betsy, played by Sybil Shepherd.
Sybil Shepherd is working at the Palatine offices, campaign office. Palatine is a senator who's running for president in an upcoming election. He's actually hoping to get the nomination at this point in the movie. She's working in the campaign offices, which are at 63rd and Broadway, we think, in a building that no longer exists. And she has an amazing first outfit at the time that we see her. She has one of these kind of like pantsuits, if I remember it, and like giant lapels that you could hang on for a while.
She
looks like a piece of clip art out of a Dr. Zizmore ad in the subway. You know, the women who are like, clean up those varicose veins.
Mm-hmm.
And she's standing around looking fabulous. That's how Betsy looks the first time. And De Niro just parks outside. He cannot help but look in through the windows at her sitting there.
I mean, do you remember that kind of creepy thing he says where it's like, they cannot touch her? Like, it's like this one of the more notably creepy things that he says up front. Tom, I just have to read something really funny. The June in 1975, so before the movie came out, when they were filming it in New York, the New York Times actually ran a whole article on the Palatine campaign.
Oh.
Quote, "The New Yorkers for Palatine, or Palatine, for President Committee, opened its headquarters in a storefront at Broadway and 63rd Street yesterday. Within hours, scores of New Yorkers had dropped in and asked, who's Palatine? Palatine is a presidential hopeful in the Columbia Pictures movie Taxi Driver, now being shot on location in New York. Leonard Harris, the former WCBS TV drama critic, is playing the role of Palatine."
Oh, fantastic.
"The Broadway storefront is playing the role of the campaign headquarters, complete with a large New Yorkers for Palatine for President Committee billboard along the front of the building and a large poster on the 63rd Street sign, which features a picture of candidate Palatine, alias Harris, surrounded by smiling children and the caption, registered July 20th, New York primary." So,
you know, that could be very confusing if you lived like a block away, and especially if that wasn't the primary date. Was that even a primary?
Was that
an election year?
I'd have to check, but I don't think so.
Oh, not 1975, 76.
Yeah. So very confusing. Now, let's get in the building here with Betsy, because one of my favorite little, I think, underused parts of the movie.
I know what it is. Is it when she pulls a little prank? Or that's later?
Well, no, that is like a part of that prank. I mean, overall, the performance of Albert Brooks as Tom, who we first meet when he's like arguing over something that had been printed about "We Are the People," which is the slogan that he's using. He's like,
"Not we the people."
"Not we the people." This is actually his first film, Albert Brooks. He made comedy albums, and he was actually like distinguished himself by being the film director of the little shorts on Saturday Night Live in 1975. Isn't that interesting?
Really?
So this was and he's like such an accomplished actor and director today, but this is his first appearance and very, very notable.
In fact, he has this kind of, you know, on and off sort of flirtation with Betsy. You know, we don't really know if they're dating, if there's a little office romance happening.
But it's like a screwball. It's like the one part, it's almost like from another movie, because it feels very screwball to me.
But I think that's the intention, right, in this film, is that they live in this sunny place with lots of windows, lots of fresh air, and comedy and happiness. And
that's true.
And goofiness. You know, she comes over and pretends to spill a coffee on him, and like a straw wrapper comes out. I mean, that is like as grisly as their world gets.
And in fact, when they notice that, you know, Travis is outside staring inside of them, she turns to Tom and she's like, "Put your glasses on so you can look." And of course, he already has his glasses on. So he like does this. "Wait a second. Okay." Which is very, very cute. And, you know, it's a... In just a few lines of dialogue with these two performances, we get like what seems to be a very complicated relationship. But anyway,
we know that relationship, having worked in offices.
Yeah, that's very true. Oh, that's true. So essentially, Tom runs out and drives Travis away. because that's very creepy.
Yeah, so, you can't just sit here, he says.
So we see Travis driving around again that night. Again, we see some wonderful old New York 42nd Street signs with a playpen for Netix. Which was orange juice.
They had an orange drink. I mean, it's back to sex and saxophones at that point because mm-hmm. you're going under the marquees. Again, it's at night.
Mm-hmm. Now, he also stops very briefly at this place called the Hotel Olcott, which was on 72nd Street. I just wanted to put this into perspective because I didn't know a lot about that building, but just to put it in a historical perspective, 5 years later, in October of 1980, one Mark David Chapman would stay at the Hotel Olcott on top of, he moved around also at the Waldorf Astoria and things like that, but he stayed there before assassinating John Lennon at the Dakota, which was also, you know, just right around the corner, essentially. So
that's disturbing.
Yes.
But back to the movie, so then we're like, you know, he's catching up with the other drivers, he's hanging out at an all-night diner.
Oh, yes.
And there's that, you know, every time we're sitting down with the guys for like a middle-of-the-night cup of coffee. And again, we should mention, if we haven't already, that he becomes a taxi driver because of this insomnia. Mm-hmm. You know, because he'd rather be out driving around and around other people than at home where he can't sleep or going to dirty movies.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He's like hanging out with the guys, but he never quite fits in with the guys. The several times we see him with the guys, he's always the oddball. There are a couple oddballs.
Well, that's such a good point because they're all oddballs, but they all try to bond with these sort of disgusting stories of sexual conquest. So Peter Boyle,
some things don't
Wizard,
change.
Yeah, Peter Boyle is there and is what he's sort of his closest confidant. I think it's him. Actually, talks about pulling off a woman's pantyhose Triborough Bridge. It's like it's very, very unsavory. There's also it brings in at this point one of these themes of his like surging racism that's coming into play here as well, because there's tables of black pimps, African-American men who are sitting there looking fairly ominous. But I think that it's more because we're looking at it from his perspective. Otherwise, it would just be people in a diner from what I remember about
scene. Right. It's a lot of men sitting by themselves at tables, all dressed up in kind of pimp wear, you know?
Yeah.
And they're holding their bodies in strange angles. So, yeah, and you're looking at his eyes, too, and then he seems disgusted.
Yes.
By the whole thing. And so then there's a close-up of him throwing Alka-Seltzer into a glass.
Right.
And there's this amazing, you know, Herman's score disappears, and you get this from the Alka-Seltzer.
Mm-hmm. Also very strange during that scene, like another cab driver attempts to sell him a piece of Errol Flynn's bathtub.
Yeah, that he got at the Pines.
Yeah, well, the Pines, but that is Errol Flynn's house in California, which I had forgotten that detail about Flynn, that he was the very like orgiastic type parties would happen famous or infamously at the Pines. So I think that was just sort of a nod to some sort of a scam artist, but also like some salaciousness that could be bought.
The New York Times calls BritBox the best of British telly. Stream acclaimed original series, including Payback, starring Peter Mullen, Stonehouse, starring Matthew McFadyen, and Archie, the man who became Cary Grant, starring Jason Isaacs. Plus, discover powerful new series like The Three Little Birds and the return of BAFTA-winning drama, Time, starring Bella Ramsey, Tamara Lawrence, and Jodie Whittaker. Stream the best of British TV, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
I mean, they hate me. Why do you think I split in the first place? There ain't nothing there.
Yeah, but you can't live like this. It's a hell. A girl should live at home.
Didn't you ever hear of women's lib?
What do you mean, women's lib? You're a young girl. You should be at home now. You should be dressed up. You should be going out with boys. You should be going to school. You know, that kind of stuff.
God, are you square?
Now, at minute 23, we're only 23 minutes into this thing. But it's the next day, and he finally has his date with Betsy. He picks her up. He takes her to Child's Coffee Shop on Columbus Circle, or about a block away. It looks like it's 58th and Broadway. And he is, you know, looking smart. He orders and tells the camera that he ordered black coffee with pie and a slice of yellow cheese, which really made me laugh. But yeah, 50th. You do see, it's amazing to look out. You can see the Columbus Circle statue in the middle. You can sort of see the main monument in the far side and see what would today be the Time Warner Center off to the left.
What's interesting, the building you don't see. Oh, and you also see the building that would become the Museum of Arts and Design.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
But what you don't see, interestingly enough, is the Colosseum itself, which was that horrid convention center that Robert Moses built. So that's just sort of convenient. So, it's such an eyesore. It just didn't fit this particular camera angle.
Which brings up the subject of what, you know, Scorsese decided to put in the shots.
Mm-hmm.
Because just like much of this, you know, anytime we're dealing with his brooding, mostly we're at night or we're at a rally. And most of the time that we're kind of feeling okay about things, he's not around and we're with Betsy and Tom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But he's also, the director here has decided what to show us and what not to show us. Even, you know, when he's driving around at night and you've got the saxophone moving, crooning, and you're looking at marquees, you're not seeing, like, modern buildings or anything that looks remotely clean.
No,
he's been
never.
Very careful, you know, to just keep it gritty.
And again, it's because we're seeing it through his eyes, and so that's how he sees the city. You know, there's a lot of theories that this is, of course, how he sees himself. So that is being reflected onto the city. But you know, realistically, there were some dirty parts of the city. So,
are you suggesting that there have been term papers written about this movie?
I think there's been whole term papers just about the rear view mirror.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and just the mirrors in the cars.
I wonder if there's been a term paper written about the Child's restaurant scene and like what he ordered.
I'm sure that the cheese on the pie, in fact, has been assiduously picked apart by film cineasts.
Cineasts.
All right. So, but now that we're back in the cab here, we should mention that there's another scene in which, quite coincidentally, Palantine himself enters the cab. Now,
was quite a coincidence.
He gets into the cab and he says, "I have learned more about America and taxi cabs than anything else." I mean, they're both. What's fascinating is they're both talking in kind of circles. And of course, Palantine, we think, is sort of revolted by some of the things that Travis Bickle is saying, although there seems to also be maybe a little bit of acknowledgement that, you know, well, you know, he could be one of our voters. You know, there's something very kind of, let's just say, very modern about that particular scene, if you ask me.
Yeah, although I can't imagine, you know, the presidential candidate at this point getting into just a yellow cab. And in fact, that's one of the first things that they say. His assistant says, like, "Are you sure we shouldn't have just waited for the limo?" You know, because who is this random cab who's just been waiting outside, what was it, the Waldorf or something? Mm-hmm. But so then Travis, you know, ends up breaking into their conversation and telling him what he would fix about the city. And that is when he says that he gets so upset about the city that sometimes he just wishes that, you know, somebody would just come along and flush it down the toilet. But before that Palantine and the cab scene, he had gone out to the terminal bar and met up with some of his, you know, cabbie friends in the middle of the night there. Now, the terminal bar was located basically on the site of today's New York Times skyscraper. You remember the terminal bar?
We actually talk about it in our Times Square in the 1970s show.
Right, exactly. And now to get there, in that scene, he passes through Times Square. Great shot of all the billboards. But what's amazing is that there's a shot of one Times Square. One Times Square with its news zipper.
Mm-hmm.
What one Times Square doesn't have in that shot are billboards, or very many billboards.
That's true.
So it's so strange to see One Times Square with its marble exterior and actually two floors of windows. So if you're watching along, take special note of that, because those are things we don't see anymore. That building is completely covered in advertising.
And yeah, I mean, it doesn't look attractive, but it looks like a completely different building.
Right.
You know? But speaking of a building that I think actually looks gorgeous, we're going to go down now to the East Village, which, you know, Tom and I have spent many, many, many years in the East Village and, you know, lived down further in the Lower East Side. And it's so interesting to see it in the 70s and see what it looked like. And it also had that grittiness of Times Square a little bit, or at least that's how it's presented here, but in kind of a different way. So we're focused specifically on an old theater called the Variety Photoplays that was on 14th Street and 3rd Avenue. We are right in front of it. It's a porn theater by this time in the movie, and it is an old 1920s theater. It was an old Nickelodeon. It was regrettably torn down, and so it's in front
and
of
that. And replaced with a steel and glass skyscraper, a 20-something story building for condos.
Yeah, just like pretty much so many other things that we're talking about here. But while in front of this, and it's just amazing to me to think of the East Village filled with all of these different things, which, reflecting that old period when Union Square was the heart of the theater world. It's here that Jodie Foster pops into the back seat. She is I believe it's 12 and a half years old. She's depicted as a young child prostitute. And she gets in the cab and she kind of wants to escape. But then
she says, "Get me out of this hell."
But then we don't see his face, but it's actually her pimp, Harvey Keitel, played by Harvey Keitel, who then grabs her, pulls her out of the cab, and then throws a wrinkled $20 bill in the front seat. A $20 bill which then hold great disturbing meaning to Travis Bickle as he shoves it into his pocket.
Keitel throws it into the front seat and says, "Forget all about this."
Mm-hmm.
And tells him basically to drive off. So that is the introduction of that character.
Yeah. Now, do we want to speak really just really briefly? I've put Jodie Foster into a little bit of context here, because she is also a very young actress at this time. I think she's about 13 or 14 years old. In fact, many people know her from her work in Disney films. Like, she debuted in Napoleon and Samantha. Remember that movie with the lion?
Yeah.
And she would actually continue making Disney films. I mean, so that's sort of interesting that she...
Like Disney's old live-action family-friendly films.
Yes. She was in several afterwards. So it's interesting that then she would make this extremely
disturbing,
vivid, and really, a movie that would set her apart from the rest of young Hollywood, I would say.
So interesting that Disney would actually continue to use her and to cast
her
even after making what was such a, you know, in many ways disturbing film.
I would agree,
film.
Yeah. So anyway, but now she represents, you know, if we're thinking about this in a Freudian sense, of the idea of goddess whore complex here, because Jodie Foster represents the, quote, whore comp part of the complex. Sybil Shepherd will be the goddess. But of course, as we know, the characters don't align with that. But again, we're seeing them through Travis Bickle's screwed up mind, where he only sees them in these very stark contrasts. So then he goes on a date with said goddess.
Right. So then the very next scene, we see him getting all clean shaven and looking very dapper, ready to go off with his goddess on this date.
Mm-hmm.
He looked great, actually. He's sporting
this
red corduroy jacket, and he got this clever idea, you know, to pick up the Kris Kristofferson album at Sam Goody.
Yeah.
At Sam Goody. And then, you know, he's ready to show it to her. And when he picks her up, you know, she's also looking good. They're going off to see, quote, a movie that he has selected. He presents her with the album, and she's like, Did you listen to this, you know, the song that I suggested? But of course he hadn't listened to it because, of course, he doesn't have a record player.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't, you know, it's like he didn't even digest that information that he told her, you know, that it wasn't about listening to that song. It was like, oh, this is a thing that I can perhaps impress her with.
And so we see that they're on different wavelengths, that they're from different places. They live different kinds of lives. I mean, she's thinking to herself, I told you to listen to this song, And she clearly, most likely, already has this album. But at the same time, it's sweet. So there's something
it
very
sweet
yes. And caring coming from his side. And it feels very sweet and lovely until we get to the theater.
Right. Now, before we get into the theater, I just have to mention really quick that they, because it's extremely, today we'd call it David Lynchian thing with the drummer, this like sweaty drummer who's like playing on the street.
Yeah.
He was actually, his name is Gene Palma, and he was a famous street drummer in New York in the 1970s and 80s. So was like literally plucked from the street themselves. So anyway, they go into the Lyric Theater. But today, if you go to the Lyric, I think you're seeing Harry Potter.
You are seeing Harry Potter, yes.
But if you go back then, what was on the marquee was a movie called Sometimes Sweet Susan. Although the movie that's played in the theater is a different movie.
Right. It's like it's a sort of Swedish, quote unquote, sex education film. So they're speaking Swedish, or maybe it's Danish. I can't really remember. But you're seeing, like, let's just say that it starts with a pretense of education, and it devolves very quickly as Betsy / Sybil squirms in her seat. And then once she realizes, I mean, it just dawns on her that she's in a porn house watching a pornographic film with a guy she doesn't even know, who clearly has a couple screws loose. And she just gets up, crawls over some people awkwardly in the seats, and gets the heck out of there.
She runs away, she ends up taking the record, doesn't she? Like, she doesn't want the record, and then finally she's just like, if it means that you'll go away. And so then we get, I guess we're to believe that, like, a few days had passed, because he's calling her from a payphone, because he sent her flowers, but of course she doesn't want to talk to him, and she doesn't want any of these flowers.
She sends them all back. So we're actually later in his apartment, and we see all of these rejected flowers that are drying on the floor.
I didn't realize that they just returned them to sender. I thought they just returned them to the florist, but, you know, I guess that's what they did back in the 70s.
But he gets so desperate, he goes to the headquarters, you know, and he's hanging out there. It's interesting there's no security guard there. He finally gets up the nerve to go in and confront her. There is a scene. It's very awkward. But you'd think that there'd be at least, you know, I guess these were the days before security guards.
Well, yeah, I mean, this movie will evoke a lot of dangerous moments in American history that would, of course, suggest the reasons we should have more security in places like this.
Right. And so it's left to Tom, you know, Betsy's, you know, sort of office boyfriend, to finally do something and drag Travis, you know, who's like about to start doing some kung fu on him, out the door, and basically pushes him off onto the corner on Broadway. Meanwhile, did you notice the name of the shop behind them? It was a fish store called Aunt Fish. You see it a couple times, yeah, when they do a shot of the front door. And I just thought, what an unusual name for a fish market.
Old New York. Well, speaking of old New York, that evening he pulls up to a bar called McGann's Bar, which is on 3rd Avenue. I'm not familiar. I think that there's other McGann's bars. I think there's even one in Port Authority, but I'm not sure if it's associated. But anyway, the most significant part here is he picks up a new customer. The customer played by Martin Scorsese. This is his second scene, and they do something that is, on one hand, somewhat Hitchcockian, because he essentially just goes up to an apartment building and they park. And in a clever little, like, in-joke, he directs Travis Bickle to look up at the window and tells him to look and to tell him, like, what is he seeing? What are you seeing? And so the woman is Martin Scorsese's wife.
Having an affair.
Right. With an African-American man, we should say, because that ties into it. But up to that point, it's Hitchcockian. But then Scorsese starts to talk about the gun that he bought and all these horrific things that he's going to do. And all of a sudden, the movie gets really even more dark, because these things, of course, put ideas into Travis Bickle's head.
So this is a moment then when the director of the film has literally changed the plot. He's the one who spins the plot, because he introduces the idea of a gun quite literally to the audience and to the driver.
Now, this play, we see one result of how this plays out in the following scene at the Belmore Cafeteria.
Yes.
Tom, this is where I remembered our Diners, Automats, Cafeteria show very well. Because I forgot that there's still these cafeteria-type places throughout the city. And this was at 28th and Park. And it had a beautiful neon sign.
And there's a great interior scene here at the Belmore Cafeteria. It's like they wanted to show us and document exactly how the cafeteria worked. Mm-hmm. You see him walk in, you see him walk up to the turnstile, a ticket come out, he takes the ticket and then he can go through the turnstile and then he gets himself, I think it's a cup of coffee and a big dry piece of cake or something.
I think so.
An overbaked piece of banana bread or something. But then he sits down with the guys.
And they have, you know, very hateful conversations.
Including one about ripping off a couple from Ohio. He said one of the drivers says, well, I wouldn't have made anything tonight if I hadn't picked up. Fortunately, I picked up a couple from Ohio at JFK and took them by Long Beach on the way into Midtown. And they were so stupid, they even gave me a $5 tip on top of it. You know, I'm just going to hold my friendly fire.
Yeah. They also, you know, talk about, you know, homosexuals not in my cab, you know, but in California, homosexuals can pay alimony.
Right, and then they're all like, oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah.
So then later outside, Travis has one of these dark confessionals with the wizard about, like, I've got some bad ideas in my head. And then you have, I mean, just that great lighting, that neon lighting that's onto the both of them.
And that's when you realize that Travis is really down in the dumps.
He's slipping off the deep end.
And he looks bad. I mean, he has gone from looking sharp to looking shaggy. And I mean Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. He suddenly looks like Shaggy. And we also have heard at this point, we know from his interview at the beginning, that he's allegedly 26 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, he is looking bad for 26 at this moment because he's just like clearly not sleeping or shaving and just looking
The next scene, he's eating bread with whiskey and milk and sugar, right? So, I mean, this is the sort of nadir of his diet because it's going to quickly change.
And he's watching TV where Palantine, the candidate, is appearing and kind of, you know, talking about how he's been speaking to every man.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, that seemed very real to me. That struck me as very real that there'd be like this candidate who's like, I've talked to the man in the street. And we know that. Well, he's talked to Travis.
We've seen him talk to one of these people. It's true. Now, just really quickly, he almost hits Jodie Foster. I'm sorry, her name is Iris in the film.
Well, or Easy, right? I mean, her sort of
Nickname.
Her nickname, her professional. We find out later her name's Iris.
Right, okay. So again, but that's down in the East Village because in the background of the scene, you can see the Gothic cabinet makers. I think that they are unfortunately closed now, but as recently as just a few years ago, it was still open, so you could actually identify that corner. And now there's like a Kiehl's is there. I think Peter Stuyvesant's old Pear Tree is on that corner, actually.
Wait a second. That was shot where the Kiehl's is on 3rd Avenue?
Ricky's is there.
Oh, yeah.
There's a Jennifer convertible, I think, there now. Now, I want to get to the next scene because I'm very excited about the fact
that would have really killed the scene if Scorsese had, like, included Jennifer convertibles in the back.
So for a couple scenes, we actually get out of Manhattan, which is hilarious because we meet Easy Andy, the traveling salesman.
Andy is quite a character. I mean, he's like, he's introduced to Travis. He gets in a cab with Travis. So he's like,
oh, that's true, right? Uh-huh.
Connections. And then they're taken to someplace. He's introduced as the salesman. And then they go into what? Is it an apartment? Is it a hotel room?
First of all, it's Brooklyn Heights. Which is kind of funny that you're going to do an illicit drug deal or gun deal. Well, he also sells drugs. A gun deal at Brooklyn Heights over the promenade in an apartment today that would be like tens of millions of dollars. But, you know, so now they're doing this deal here.
And Andy, by the way, is also wearing a very smart brown three-piece corduroy suit.
Oh, yes,
you know,
yes,
so he
yes.
looks very – and he's carrying a number of briefcases, which when he opens up and you see – that they are completely filled with guns of various sizes, you know?
I mean, these scenes kind of strike us differently today than perhaps they might have in you know, 1976, definitely, the sort of illegal gun market. But to stick to Brooklyn as a setting, then we get, after this scene, a quick workout montage, because now he's like, he's not eating his Chuckles candy anymore. He's going to work out because he's crazy and he's got something on his mind that he wants to do.
He is getting in shape. He's like getting in shape in jeans only at home. It's like he's doing a P90X, you know, circa 1976 routine.
With a knife and tapes, you know, like comes up with these ways to conceal weapons.
Yeah, there's a lot of like gun strapping. Just when you think something's just sort of like, oh, that's kind of cool. You know, he's turning it around. He's getting in shape. Then you see him like, you know, working like special magic with guns strapped to different parts of his body. But otherwise, I mean, in this scene, I made a note here that it looks like he's getting ready to go to the Pride Parade.
Well, you know, it is true with like maybe a leather chaps or something. He would fit in perfectly with no problem because he looks very svelte.
He'd have to lose though all those guns.
I want to race to the next scene here because I think it's just sort of funny in terms of how they must have made the movie. The next scene is at a campaign event for Palantine, but it's actually filmed at Cadman Plaza in Brooklyn, which is only a few blocks away from where they had shot the Easy Andy scene. So I'm just imagining that the city probably gave them a few days of a permit for a few days, and they're like, well, we're in Brooklyn, let's do these two scenes here, because they don't really, the two scenes don't relate to each other, but they just are coincidentally almost next door to each other.
And by the way, like, again, he doesn't even look like he did when he was brokenhearted and talking to his, you know, sort of mentor in the street that night.
Right.
Now he's looking sharp. This is the first time I wrote down here, he looks like Tom Cruise. There's an early Tom Cruise look that he would hold on to for much of the rest of it. He's wearing, like, he's got this new short cropped haircut, and he's wearing this, like, cool green bomber jacket. There's also a little bit of a comedy routine that he does with the Secret Service officer.
Well, it's incredibly stupid on... It's. I would actually say, if I were to find a weakness in this movie, like off the top of my head, this might be it, because it's a little contrived that he would be so stupid as to... He's clearly, like, maybe he just doesn't see that how nuts he is. So he's talking to a Secret Service officer who's like, oh, yeah, maybe you could be a Secret Service person. Why don't you give us your address? And so he gives them an address, which is clearly phony.
Right, because he can't even get the zip code, the number of digits in the zip code correct. Yeah.
So, I mean, clearly everyone's on high alert now that he's here. So anyway, so this puts him on Secret Service's radar, essentially.
In a big way. And yes, it does feel a bit contrived, but I mean, you could certainly make the same point about the fact that he somehow coincidentally picked up Palantine in the first place.
That was pretty contrived. Now,
but then we go in the very next scene into probably the most famous part of the entire film, the "You Talking to Me" scene.
Now, this, you know, because it's so iconic and stands out from the rest of the movie. It's in every film montage that the Oscars have ever shown. But I forgot how insane he is in here. It's not just like, he's not just being like, you know, like looking at himself, like, look how hot I am. Like, are you like, he's not like kind of doing a fake flirtation with himself. There's like this menace and darkness to this scene that, you know, you lose it when it gets cut out and thrown into the film retrospective.
Right. With like soaring orchestration underneath it.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's even choppy editing, you know, done on Scorsese's part, that makes you feel, when you're watching it, like, you feel disturbed. You know that this guy is tormented.
Yes, it's really on edge. And then this culminates into an insane scene that evening in a convenience store where he is in the back when someone goes in to attempt to rob it. He has his gun on and kills the man. And again, it's the thief in this case is a black man. So this is another culmination of this like racist unrest that's also kind of part of his violence.
It's also the first time, obviously, that he uses a gun on another person.
Yeah.
Although he's been waiting to use a gun, this is the first time he actually does.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also the first time that it seems like he even stops for a second. Once he has shot the man, he stops and even considers, like, oh, wait a second, what am I going to do? I don't know what I'm supposed to do now.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you know, the owner of the deli, who he seems to be friends with, says, just get out of here, give me the gun, get out of here, I'll take care of it.
Yeah, so it's like he was able to, like, perform violence without any repercussions. It's very weird, dark.
A very unsettling scene, and it even gets scarier in a way, because then the owner of the deli starts beating the man with an iron club. So, I mean, he's already been shot. Things are getting dark.
Yeah. So, where do you want to go?
This is why I stick to musicals.
Well, so there's another scene of him writing a happy anniversary card to his mom.
Yeah.
He's really, really kind of losing control.
And you feel that he's, you know, he's like brooding and grasping his shotguns. He's becoming more and more isolated. And then he attends one of the Palatine rallies.
Uh-huh.
It seems like he's in the garment district, just judging from the buildings around him. And he doesn't ultimately do anything, but just his presence there. He's in the car, and a police officer forces him this time to keep moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we're starting to get nervous every time we see him that he's going to use that gun again.
He's just going to burst forth with this rage.
And he's back in his crappy apartment, you know, looking at the TV, which he accidentally knocks over at one point. And meanwhile, you still see that sign on his wall that says, one of these days, I'm going to get organized.
Organized.
Which is a running joke.
Incredibly cheesy sign to sort of like offset all of this. Now, he goes back down to 3rd Avenue and 12th Street. 3rd Avenue and 13th Street, because he now wants to like meet Iris, Jodie Foster's character. And so he has the pretense of hiring her for sex. $15 for 15 minutes, $25 for half an hour. We hear from her pimp, played by Harvey Keitel. Now, they already joke it with him. They call him a copper, that they think that he's a cop, which again brings into this idea that, you know, Scorsese took from all these old cowboy an Indian cops and robbers movie. So there's this dark subtext of calling him like a good guy in this scene.
Right. Calling him both a cop and then calling him a cowboy.
Yeah.
He's called both of those things. I mean, what he isn't called is just like, you know, kind of nutty. Because he walks up to Keitel and just says like, yeah, how about, you know, I want a good time or whatever. He's like, clearly, he looks like an oddball. He's approaching this pimp in such an obvious manner that, and he's an unknown customer. So clearly, everybody feels ill at ease every time they see him.
Everyone,
they be like working for a campaign or whether they be working in prostitution. You know, nobody is like comfortable when they're first approached
by
Travis.
This is a cool dude coming up. No one is thinking that about Travis Bickle. So then,
except maybe Iris.
Yeah. So then when they go up, it's true that she lights a cigarette and she's like, when that cigarette is out, we're done.
Right. And I was like, really? A cigarette takes 15 minutes to burn?
So maybe she was trying to cheat him.
Or maybe they were Virginia Slims, you know, really long.
Misties. Of course, he doesn't want to, quote, make it with her.
No.
He said, don't you want to make it?
It takes her several, thankfully, unsuccessful attempts before she realizes this guy's just kind of kooky.
Yeah.
He wants to sit here and talk to me. And then he invites her, interestingly, when his time's up, he invites her to breakfast the next day.
Oh, that's true. Before we get to breakfast.
Breakfast at 1.
Uh-huh. 1 o'clock. That's right. Yeah. I just have to say really quickly that, like, the room, which is, like, I think it's that he pays $10 for the use of the room.
20 at the end.
20 at the end. That's true. That room's kind of nice. It's nicely decorated.
Yeah,
it's
that actually threw me off. I was like, I think I've been to a party, like a house party in that room.
That was a little surprising.
Right. So, a lot of reds and pinks and candles.
Oh, yeah, all the candles.
A record player.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, the diner. Let's get to the diner.
Okay, so they go to breakfast the next day in an East Village diner, looks like. I love it from the outside. There's a guy, did you see, scooping Gino's Italian ices?
Oh, yeah.
Which is like a sign and a sort of like cart that you still see around today.
I know. I mean, that is like some things never change, thank God. Most things do, but not Gino's.
One thing that also has changed are Iris's glasses. She has the most amazing green glasses in that first moment we see her. She actually switches them to different glasses in the scene. She changes her glasses.
Oh, she does. That is so fashionable. But she, you find out in this scene how interesting and powerful she is. I mean, you ever heard of women's lib? You ever try looking at your own eyeballs in the mirror? I mean, she says these kind of wacky things, but they suggest a kind of a deeper person, but also like makes you the audience. I mean, look, she got nominated for an Academy Award for this performance because in these just few scenes, you really fall for her, and you're just like, oh, this is someone who's going to make something out of their life if they can get out of this situation. And Travis Bickle, in his broken mind, thinks that like he can. You know, as he's going to, like, attempt to assassinate a presidential candidate, this same part of his mind is also like, I need to save this person.
Yeah. And meanwhile, we find out that she believes, that Iris believes that Keitel, her pimp, actually loves her. So she's delusional in her own ways. Not knowing, of course, the terrible and sleazy promises that he makes to the customers on the street. And then she also tells Travis at this point that just someday she wants to move out. Where does she want to go? She wants to go off and live in Vermont in a commune, which is so, you know, incongruous at that point, unless you think that, well, actually, you know, like she's not living in a commune, but she's living with a bunch of other people at this point, obviously. It seems so far away and so far removed from the scene. She doesn't even really know what that would be like.
No.
And Travis has a hilarious line because he's like, commune, I've never been, but it doesn't sound clean. I actually thought that was the funniest line in the whole play. I mean, it's not a laugh riot, you know, this movie, but that made me stop and laugh.
Well, and it's because I almost feel like it's more, it's not just like a physically clean, that there may be like he's making some kind of a moral judgment there too. Because we've seen him we've seen him talk about cleanliness many times in this movie, and it's not what he don't mean like scrub the floors.
Well, he sometimes means wipe the back seat.
Oh, that's true. Oh, that
so
is
he
true.
He talks about all forms, and now we're just back into like film school dissertation territory. Yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of cleanliness talk.
So let's jump ahead to one of the potentially most disturbing parts of this movie, because he is now going to get ready to go free Betsy by impress Betsy by going to assassinate candidate Palantine. He even like signs over all of his money to Iris, right? In anticipation that he's not going to survive or he's going to get arrested or something. So then he heads up to a campaign event in Columbus Circle. And the framing of this is such an interesting Scorsese does such an interesting job framing it, because Palantine is right in front of the main monument. And the main monument was done.
Maine as in M-A-I-N-E.
Yes, a monument to the USS Maine, which exploded in Havana, Cuba in 1898. This the monument was put up there in 1913, and it's about as ostentatious as you can find. In New York City. So he is almost in this symmetrical frame. You know, the front of it has a little boy like opening his arms up. So those are like on either side of Palantine.
And Palantine even addresses the location when he steps up to the mic to speak after Tom introduces him.
Uh-huh.
Palantine says something like, here we are, ladies and gentlemen, standing here at a crossroads in history. And we're standing at a crossroads of the city, referring to Columbus Circle and the crossroads of, you know, the crossing of Broadway and of 8th Avenue and of 59th Street. So he kind of makes this interesting grid analogy.
Yeah, it's
that
true.
At least, you know, I kind of was I was into it. I'd vote for Palantine just because of that.
Well, what makes this scene so disturbing, well, there's two things about it, and they have nothing to do with what's in the movie. You know, first of all, according to Paul Schrader, that this scene was directly inspired by the assassination attempt on George Wallace by Arthur Bremer. But number two, of course,
and let me guess,
yes,
is the fact that Travis shows up. We see him get out. We see him kind of arrive. We only see kind of lower body. We're looking at his arms because we know that he's packing heat. Somewhere he's concealing, you know, weapons with his like crazy holsters that he has hidden. But then we see him for the first time. We see his full body, and we see that he has shaved all but a mohawk on his head. And it's just so striking. I mean, all of a sudden, it's like he is a warrior. He shows up to assassinate this nominee, a warrior.
Well, and then the thing to remember is that punk music, which would, of course, like take the mohawk as a fashion statement, is just arriving in the world. So really, this mohawk is more of like an Indian, you know, a Native American look. And that is, of course, following in with the whole cowboys and Indian thing that Scorsese is doing with this movie.
I wish that I could, at this point, direct our listener to listen to our most recent podcast on New Amsterdam, Part 1, or the original Native New Yorkers, you know, where we speak at length about the Lenape. But I just don't see anything.
I don't think that Lenape.
I don't think we said really anything of value to this.
Well, I don't think I'm not sure if the Lenape wore a mohawk style, but maybe. Maybe. I'm not going to. I just wanted to. Before we leave to go to the next scene, the most disturbing thing about this scene is that this was the scene that inspired John Hinckley Jr., who was obsessed with Jodie Foster. In the movie, saw this as a way to impress her. Like, he wanted to, in a way, copy Travis Bickle's, was intending to do, which was to assassinate in some sort of, like, twisted mind idea that this was going to, like, impress Jodie Foster in the same way that Travis thinks it's going to somehow free or impress Betsy.
And then Hinckley, of course, went off to make an attempted assassinate. To make an assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. Yeah. And so this is life imitating art.
But actually in the movie, he doesn't end up, you know, the Secret Service, because they've already identified him. He's not able to make an attempt on the life of Palantine. So he goes downtown for the most epic and the most violent scene in the film, and he decides if he can't save Betsy, then he will save Easy/Iris, and then goes on this bloody killing spree, shooting Keitel, going inside the building on 13th Street, doing a horrific blowing of the hand off of the guy who works there, and then essentially just this huge bloodbath emerges. It's that pent-up horror that we've seen through the whole movie. But what happens is that in saving Iris, the big twist
now,
of the
hold
movie,
on, this yeah? is a spoiler. I guess we've been spoiling it throughout this entire thing.
The big twist of the movie is that this evil, this that has been simmering, is interpreted through these events as a local hero. He becomes like the great vigilante hero that New York in the mid-1970s is looking for.
Yes, and he's only there to become a hero because he has failed to kill himself. He, in fact, his very last shot he intends to take on himself, toward himself, but he can't because he's out of bullets. So there's an additional layer of irony there because he's tried to off himself,
mm-hmm.
and he sees probably that is the logical conclusion of things. Never in his wildest fantasies would he have imagined being treated as a hero.
No. Now, this seems like perhaps a little bit of a stretch that this man could just go in and just murder a bunch of people and then be considered a hero just because of who those people were. But in fact, the city, you know, this would occasionally happen and sometimes still does happen. For instance, you have Bernard Goetz in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm, 84.
Is rewarded for such vigilantism
This scene, by the way, the shootout was so disturbing, so grotesque, that Scorsese desaturated the colors to make it a little bit more bearable. I also want to point out the fact, again, that this was shot on location. Even those scenes the shootout scene in the apartment itself, which is a real New York City apartment, were shot in that apartment space. To do that, they had to take out a whole part of the ceiling so that the cameras could fit up there and shoot down from the floor above where Iris's apartment was. But much of that scene is shot from overhead. You're casing out the joint overhead looking down on this horrific scene.
This is one of these scenes that's like... was so influential that it almost seems like a copy of something because we've seen it copied.
But, so
many times.
And under the whole thing, you've got Bernard Herrmann's score. You know, you've got timpanis banging, and harps strumming. You know, so this is a different soundtrack at this point. We don't have Travis's saxophone theme here at all.
No.
But it...
it pops up one more time.
Yes,
at the
it
very
comes back
end.
In the very next scene when he picks up... after we see that he has survived, and then he's back in his cab.
He stops at the St. Regis briefly.
He goes to pick up a fare at the St. Regis, and who pops in? But of course, Sybil Shepherd / Betsy sits in the back, and we hear a "Hello, Travis" from the back seat, which is very Umbrellas of Cherbourg, because it is again our two sort of heroes or anti-heroes coming together one last time. The love that couldn't happen because they were from different places and in different wavelengths, really.
And then interestingly, it's also, I think it reveals some shallowness to Betsy because she seems like she's interested because she read about it in the newspaper, right? Like, wouldn't, if that event hadn't happened.
Well, there was no Facebook.
No one could tweet out that he had done this. So if this event hadn't happened, this event of absolute rage that was supposed to have actually assassinated the man that she worked for, now it's like, he's a hero now. And so there's like a softness to her voice. I don't think that she would have gotten back with him. I mean, I think
there's a realization there that those two are just from different places.
Yeah.
She even says that, you know, when she runs out of the porn theater, like an hour and 20 minutes before, she says, we're different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a realization that she has some kind of love for him, but it's just, they're different.
Yeah.
And there is, of course, one last moment in this, because it doesn't just end like that. He doesn't just drive off and we all kind of have that ache in our hearts. Because he has to make one last crazy look in the rearview mirror as if something just caught his eye and
he snapped again,
a flash of something dark.
What's those red and blues? The city, the blurred city comes back in, the steam comes back in.
The kaleidoscopic images of 42nd Street come back in.
And what we realize is that skewed view of the city has not shaken that by being a hero, that in fact that like if this film had been made 5 years ago, there would be a sequel, because that is what a classic setup of a sequel would be like, of like, oh, but the killer's not dead, you know?
Right.
And so then he goes off into the steam and the credits roll. Well, so we're closing the book here. I'm sure we'll be visiting another Marty film in the near future, because many of them, from the Age of Innocence to Gangs of New York, have New York history settings. So,
would like to thank you, patrons, for not just joining us today, but for supporting us on patreon.com/Bowery Boys. It really is because of your support that we're able to dedicate our time to making the show. So... thank you so much for your help.
Well, have a great New York week, whether you live here or not.
We'll see you at the movies.